right, welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. My guest tonight is a man who was formerly in the employ of what some people refer to as the global elite, the Illuminati. They go by a lot of different names. He is a scientist who has worked with some of the most famous scientists on the planet and is himself rather famous. There came a time when he felt that he could work for this group no longer, and he became a whistleblower, exposing their schemes and shining a little bit of light into some dark corners. There was a period of danger for him and his family, but he has pushed forward with informing and educating the rest of us. Stan Deo, welcome to the Kevin Smith Show.
Good to be here, Kevin. How are things over in your part of the world?
Things in my part of the world are quite nice today.
Nice?
Yeah, the weather's been really nice here today.
Well, we've had good weather here, too, in Colorado.
I have, a lot of people think it's a little strange. I actually prefer bad weather. I'm just that sort. I like the sky dark and lots of rain or snow, and but it's I recognize the fact that I'm not like everyone else. So based on everybody else's standards, it's been very nice here today.
Ah, all right. Well, I understand that now, I think.
Stan, you've been with us several times here on the show, and let me just start by telling you I really appreciate you carving out a couple of hours of your time to be with us and talk with us here and continue informing and educating us. Your work has, over the years, been absolutely fascinating. For us, it may be just plain vanilla for you, I don't know, but for us, it's all fascinating. And when I talked with you a few days ago, you shared with me something that absolutely blew my socks off. Something happening on this planet, or has already happened, and we didn't know it. Can you share that with us?
Well, you're probably referring to the work I've been doing with the help of about 100 other testers across the planet in 17 countries. Back in 2008, I found a way to measure changes in the Earth's gravitational field using a car battery, some wire, and a little laser pointer, and some reflective surface. And when I did that, I thought, back in 2008, I did it with my son and some other friends in Queensland, down Australia, and here in Colorado. Ran this test, and I found that this wire would twist suddenly when you put a short current across it from the battery, and then broke the circuit, and you just tapped the wire on the battery terminal. And I thought, I wonder if it does the same thing down the southern hemisphere. So I had them duplicate the experiments I was doing, and lo and behold, it did the opposite. So I thought, okay, maybe that's magnetic fields, and I did some tests to eliminate that, and eventually went to a test where I had a wire hanging straight vertically up from the surface of the Earth, like from the floor up to the ceiling, and taped it so that I could see how it twisted. And we got a real surprise when we did that test. It didn't alternate directions. It went in the same direction twice, no matter what battery terminal we connected to what end. So I had him do it down in Australia, and also had another guy by the time in New Zealand doing it, and he got the same result, but reversed. That was back in 2008. Okay. Now, time passed, and I wrote the electricity paper, the Gemstone one, which is on our website, and telling about what we'd found out with the horizontal hanging wires in the battery and what that meant, and, you know, developed some new equations for electricity that didn't involve, you know, charge or that kind of stuff. It's very straightforward type equations. Algebra, you know, nothing simple, nothing complex, is very simple. Then, this year, about a month ago, I thought, well, I better just check, and I'll put out a call on our website for people to volunteer from all over the planet and be sure that the results we're getting aren't being affected by magnetism of the poles, by nearby magnetic substances, by telluric currents down underneath the surface of the Earth, by sunspots, all this kind of stuff. So when I got all these people start to help and send in data, and they're all still sending in now. To my surprise, all the stuff in the southern hemisphere had reversed from what it was in 2008. Here we are 2 years and a bit later, and their results have turned upside down, which if it was just magnetic pole stuff and that kind of stuff, it should be the same as it was 2008. And it didn't matter where we're getting results from, we're getting the same kind of results. So I went back and started scratching my head thinking, what is happening here? And without going into the incredible detail necessary to explain, let me say that I'm pretty sure that what we're seeing is that atoms on the planet all line up like their vertical spin axis, all point straight at the core of the planet, no matter where the atom is. In other words, every atom on the planet in its normal rest state is like a spinning top, spinning at about 50 million times a second. Each little atom, its axis is pointing straight down toward the center of the planet. They're all polarized, in other words. So we found out with the test that when we hung a wire straight up and down and pulsed it, the wire started to shrink and kept shrunk. The atoms actually got closer together in the wire. And this then told me that my theory my hypothesis of gravitation was very close to being a theory and a workable theory, that we were able to see changes in gravity by watching the changes in the atoms. Now, what that means, if I'm correct, is that in 2008, all of our atoms were pointed, you know, down toward the center of the Earth, and between 2008 and now sometime, they flip-flopped, and they're all upside down. Now, that's crazy, I know. It sounds pretty weird because, you know, I didn't feel anything different in the last 2 years that suddenly everything flipped. Maybe it was a gradual process. But if this is happening, and what we're already seeing now is that the directions that the atoms are lined up in at the moment, we think they're starting to drift a bit, which means we could be seeing something down inside the planet starting to change the axis of spin of the planet, like a pole shift. Now, whether it reverses the poles of the spin or not is another issue, but I think it is actually starting to change the axis of spin. And we've been getting emails from people that had no idea what we were doing, saying, hey, have you noticed the shadows of the sun is casting on our garden walls and stuff are different for this time of year than they were last year? And one guy wrote in and said, look, you know, this is probably, you know, wrong, but he said, I've been noticing weird things with my compass in my area, the magnetic field, and I've also been checking Chandler's wobble and a few other things on the Earth's axis. And that has virtually changed and come to a stop and then started again. So there is something going on out there, and I just happened to get all these people together across the planet and start testing it right in the middle of it. And, you know, I am rushing as fast as I can, Kevin, to write this down in a coherent form, logical, with illustrations and animations and pictures, so that people all over the world, even more qualified than I am to do this kind of stuff, will say, aha, we can do it better, we can do it more, and let's see what's happening here. We've got a new tool. And if this is the case, then we're going to be able to watch the change in the gravitational and the magnetic field in a way we've never been able to before, and maybe be able to know when a serious major pole shift is coming.
Well, now you bring up something that I've been thinking about ever since we talked, and that is the relationship between magnetism and gravity. Is there a relationship between the magnetic field and the gravitational field? And if so, what is that relationship?
Okay. First of all, you know, I did work down with Dr. Teller's group on anti-gravity in Australia. I was recruited in 1971 for a very, you know, classified project. Now, my side of it was working on what's called plasma dynamic aircraft, or flying saucers using charged air. But right across the way from me, the guys were working on anti-gravity using electricity. Now, they showed me, you know, I was allowed to see photographs inside the assembly area for the 30-foot diameter craft. And they used two coils wrapped around something like a donut with a bite out of it. And these coils had wire in them, just one layer of wire in each coil. And the wire was about 3/8 of an inch to half an inch thick, and about 4 to 5 inches wide. It was a big current-carrying wire. Now, they said they used pulsed direct current to create a spinning vortex, like a tornado, of direct current magnetic field inside that donut, and that's what generated a local gravitational field around the craft and through it and through the crew members. Now, that alone tells me, you know, that we have a direct relationship between pulse, direct current, you know, spinning fields, and gravity. Now, my test is a very low current form of that same kind of relationship. Basically, everything that has gravity, even atoms, has to have spin in the fluid of space around an axis. If you don't have spin, you don't have gravity. And I've gone on to look at this even in more depth, Kevin, to see how gravity really works. And it is not a one-directional force in the universe. There are actually two directions to it, one going toward the center of a planet or a star, and one coming out, a reflection. And the sum of those two generate a surface, which we call the surface of a star, surface of a planet. And it's led me to develop models which show strands, if you wish, of the vortices that create gravity. And when I put this all together and made an animation of it in the computer, I thought, wow, this makes an interesting pattern at the poles of any planet or sun or a galaxy that we should be able to see from the photographs NASA has of our inner planets. So I started looking through NASA's photographs, the public photographs, and I found proof that this field pattern is there. And if people are listening to us here and later, when you replay this show, if you go to my website at standeo.com, S-T-A-N-D-E-Y-O.com, and if you're listening now, go there now, and you'll see Kevin Smith's show there, and you'll see in brackets there, show images. And that's what you want to click on, because it's going to take you to what I'm talking about now and show you images of the North Pole of Mars, of Tethys 2, the North Pole of a moon of Saturn. It's going to show you the Saturn's North Pole and these vortexual spinning patterns that form at the poles. And it's going to show you some of my animation stills showing what I call the containment field versus the fields of the atoms that are contained within a planet or a star or whatever. And you're going to see these spirals. Now, we're getting even more information in that I'll put in the paper, but this is stuff I threw up quick for the show. And you'll see, down about the middle of that, you'll see some drawings, computer renderings of how I see the solar system now with waves going out and forming specific orbits, orbits where planets have to orbit or they can't be stable. And my formula for that is a simple algebraic progression, and I was able to pick every planet's orbit from Mercury right on out to Pluto and beyond, and I found six orbits that weren't occupied, that could house a planet if we wanted to put one there. Now, one planet I couldn't find, but there is a distinct orbit out so far from the sun that it's 250 times the distance that Earth is from the sun. And this puts it beyond the Kuiper Belt and almost a quarter of the way to the edge of what's called the Oort cloud, where all the comets live. Now, NASA, surprise, surprise, has just announced they think there is a planet out there, beyond what I found, that is about 4, maybe 10 times as big as Jupiter, and that it's moving around out there in this Oort cloud and causing a lot of the comets and unknown things that we're seeing coming into the solar system now, or into the inner solar system, because it's shaking them out of their stable orbits out there in that Oort cloud. Now, that Oort cloud itself is so big in diameter, it's a big shell around our solar system. If you shot a light beam from one side of it to the other, it would take over 1.25 years for the light to reach the other side. That's how big it is, over 1.25 light years in diameter. Now, getting back to the one that I found just beyond the Kuiper Belt at 250 times the distance of the Earth from the sun, that is what we call a mean orbit. The planet that would occupy that would have to have a very long elliptical orbit, where one end of its orbit went around the sun and the other end went out beyond 250 and back. But the average of its orbit would be 250. Now, I calculated the angle that it would have to spin around the sun at about 23.5 degrees above the equator, if you wish, or the ecliptic plane around the sun. And I also calculated that its orbital time, and this really made my hair stand on end, its orbital time, sure as I sit here, is 3,600 years, plus or minus 12 years. Now, that is very close to what we've been hearing bantered around about this Planet X, Nibiru, that kind of stuff. Now, don't you?
Well, okay, so what you're saying is that your calculations show where all the orbits of the planets in our solar system would have to be, and all of our planets are where they are supposed to be. There are six vacant orbits, but this one vacant orbit may not be vacant, and it matches what Sitchin said about Nibiru.
Yes, yes. Now, I will say this. Neptune is not exactly where it should be, but NASA has also agreed in what I'm saying, that Neptune is being pushed down in its orbit, closer to the sun a bit, because of some unknown large mass orbiting out there. I think that might be this Nibiru-type planet that everyone's been talking about.
Let me ask you this. Prior to doing this work and these calculations, what did you think about Sitchin and what he had to say about Nibiru?
Well, I got to be honest. I didn't think much of it, and I may not agree with everything now that he has said and interpreted from the writings, because there are other interpretations, more modern, that disagree with what he said. However, that was before I found this out, and now I believe there is a mystery planet out there, at least one, maybe more, and I calculated its speed, and if it is making a near approach sometime around the year 2012, I calculate that it will be making an entrance into our inner orbits, diving in from an angle, probably from underneath the planet on the south side, and cutting into the orbit of, say, the asteroids or Mars, and going around the back of the sun and then back out into Mars' orbit and back out back home. And that journey will take about 11 to 12 years. So it may already be present somewhere we're not seeing it or not being told about it because it doesn't emit enough light or something. I've heard a number of discussions on the fact that it might be a dwarf star, that it's a dark planet that, you know, it's not reflecting light. There could be a number of reasons for that.
All right. We're going to have to step away for break, but you have just caused both my eyebrows to raise, and I have a question about the presence of this planet coming into our solar system and the stuff you've been observing in your experiments. So we'll get to that when we come back.
Come on, get out. Well, you're home. wanna shake what God gave you. He made you to have some fun, maybe find someone. Tell me, what are you afraid of now? You know, just between us, you can't download love. Get out, get out the house, out in the street, get out in your town. Get off the couch, get on the light, and get on life. Bust down, feel like you're leaving. Life ain't about just breaking even. Live a little, love a lot. Come on, come on, come on, get out. Chair. 99% of life is, yep, just be there. Get out the house, out in the street, get out in your town, get off. Get off the couch, get off the line, and get on life, bust down. Feel like you're leaving, life ain't about just breaking even. Get out the house, out in the street, get out of your town, get off. Get off the couch, get off the line, and get on life, bust down. Cause life ain't about just breaking even.
And welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. My guest this evening is Stan Deo. And Stan, I said I have a question as we went to break, but actually I have three questions, and that will be the third one. Let's go back to your experiment for a moment, and I realize that you've had people all over the world assisting you running this experiment. But is there any data, third-party data, like from NASA, that would tend to corroborate what you're looking at, or is it too early for that?
It's too early for that, quite honestly. I have to get all the data together, plot them on a map, analyze them, and then publish my opinion, you know, on what's causing all this, and then wait for kind of peer review on it.
All right. Second question. You were talking about these gravitational vortices at the poles. Does this say anything about the possibility of a hollow Earth theory?
That's a great question. Great question. Yes, it does. The thing that I discovered with that, if you can look at the images, the second image I've got, there's a hollow Earth cross section, and these gravitational waves, I believe the way they form, make planets and stars and galaxies expand in diameter as they get older, and the core of the galaxy, the core of a sun or the core of a planet or a moon, has layers to it, and the outer layer or layers eventually unwind and become rings of dust or broken up particles like around Jupiter or Saturn. Both of them have orbital rings. Now, I don't know at this point whether they were originally part of a shell structure on the surface of Saturn and Jupiter, but certainly the Earth and Mars and various moons of Saturn, everything that we can find and get pictures of shows that the planets and the moons have expanded in diameter. And I'm not the only one that has noticed this or worked on it. In England, H.G. Owen, O-W-E-N, has put out an atlas on the continental displacement of the planet's continents over the last 200 million years. And he has found and evidenced that the continents were all together in one landmass way back when the Earth was 80%, maybe 75% smaller than it is now, and that it expanded, and this plate tectonic stuff is all a result of a catastrophic expansion period where the Earth blew up like a balloon and broke up that landmass into the continents we have today. And it didn't happen at inches per year. It happened rapidly. And the reason I say that is because there's records in one of the ancient pharaohs of Egypt where he complained about the earth groaning and mumbling during his reign. And this was also during the time of the biblical patriarch Peleg, P-E-L-E-G. And his name means that he was born in the time of the dividing of the earth, when the continents were breaking apart.
I'm surprised you knew about Peleg.
Why?
Most people don't.
Oh, well, I studied quite a bit of that and translated quite a bit of the Bible from the Hebrew. But
yeah, that's exactly what his name means. He was named Peleg, which means division, because he was born in the time when the earth divided. Absolutely,
yeah.
Correct.
Now, if your listeners would like to see another guy's work on this, there's a man named Neil Adams who has animated with actual pictures Mars and Earth and a moon or two, and our moon as well, showing when you decrease the diameter of these planets and moons back to their original state, that all the continents and features on the planet fit together like a glove. And it proves that the planet was smaller at some time and broke as it expanded. Now, there's three links I put there, one for Mars, the animation of it, one for the Earth, the animation of it from, you know, however many million years ago it was, how it was until it blew up like it is now. Plus, I give you a link to Neil Adams' website, because he's well known in the cartoon and comic book industry as an illustrator, and he has 9 clips on there that you can go to and see and understand his take on why the planets are expanding. It's not exactly the same as mine, and that doesn't matter. What it matters is he shows you what I'm talking about with real animations of real images of these planets and moons. And I think once people have seen that, they're going to think, wow, you know, planets do expand. And people have asked me, you know, that I've talked to about this, I said, well, okay, but why isn't it happening now? And I think these things from my equations, that these expansions happen at specific times in the age of the planet or the star or whatever, and they are sudden. They're catastrophic. When they hit this region, the poles open up, and the surface starts to flatten out and become a ring around that planet or the star or the galaxy. So I thought, well, if this is happening here on Earth anytime soon, that would mean if we have a hot inner core and maybe a void inside the planet between that core and our surface, that heat would come out in the poles as they started to open. And it would also mean that there ought to be some evidence of a hole at the north or south pole. We've all heard about Admiral Byrd and all this kind of stuff flying over to North Pole, and he flew further than he thought he could, and he was inside in some other place. But we could never get verification, you know, positive proof that he actually said that in his diary.
Mm-hmm.
But right now, there is a mysterious heating of the Arctic, and the ice is melting. And down to the South Pole, the Russian base at Vostok, which is just very close to the South Pole, has found a lake, a warm water lake, 2.25 miles under the surface of the ice, mm-hmm. right on top of the South Pole. Now, they stopped drilling that hole before they got into the lake. They were about 0.2 miles short, but I think they're going to start it again, but they had a mysterious stopping, and it was postponed for, I think, about a year. No one explained why, really, but I think they found more than they bargained for when they started drilling down into there. It got warmer and warmer, and to me, that indicates a polar opening forming. And if you look at the Google Earth photo of Vostok Base from space, and I've got it there. It's the second row, the middle photograph. I've got it there on that images for the show tonight. And you'll see a hole in the photograph, and it's big, I mean, compared to a base.
Mm-hmm.
And that's Vostok Base. And I think that is proof that we're getting a hole opening up. I may be wrong, but there is something happening down there that's warm. And, you know, down in that ice pack, it should be like, you know, freezing. But it's at 27 degrees Fahrenheit, which is just, well, 5 degrees short of 32 degrees, which is freezing for water. But it's real warm for that part of the world. Normally, you're talking about minus temperatures down there.
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Yeah, that's enough on that. I don't want to belabor the point.
Okay, so let's go to the third question, the question I said I was going to ask when we went to break. And this brings us back to this orbit that exactly, or pretty closely, fits Sitchin's story about Nibiru. It would take 3,600 years for a planet in that orbit to make a complete circuit, which is what Sitchin said about Nibiru. All right, let's assume that in that orbit there is such a planet. Let's assume that it is incoming. Let's assume that it's as close as you were talking about. If it's going to make its appearance in 2012, it ought to start entering the inner solar system this year. Okay, with all of those assumptions, could this planet and its current proximity to the Earth be a causal factor for gravitational inversion on this planet?
Good question. My first response would be, I don't think so, because I think the polar reversals occur in the Sun normally. I mean, I know the magnetic reversals occur every 22 years, what's called the Hale magnetic cycle, but the solar polar inversions or gravitational field inversions may be such long period events that we've never seen it before. However, having said that, because my theory of gravity is modifying what traditional physics sees, there are invisible spiral waves, standing waves around planets, moons, suns, galaxies, and these standing waves are where these planets can orbit. Now, if a planet is coming in and hitting one of those orbits, crossing through it in its traverse, it will put ripples into that orbit, and those ripples will affect the planets in those orbits. Now, how much it will affect it is another issue. The NASA has recently, in the last 6 months, announced that the Pioneer 10 and 11 probes, which are at about 75 times the distance of the Earth from the Sun now, that they have encountered a mysterious fifth force in the universe, some kind of a drag that is trying to pull them back toward the Sun, a subtle, weaker force they didn't know existed. And my containment field theory is that force. So it is weaker than normal concentrated gravity when all the atoms are compacted into a planet or a star, but it's a secondary form of gravity in the spinning waves around the Sun and around planets and moons and galaxies. Now, because of that, I'm almost positive now that my theory is correct. My hypothesis is a theory, and that we do have this weak gravitational field which is containing atoms that form planets, and you can shake it up. You can inject things from a long distance away, much further away than we thought possible, because modern physics would say, well, gee, Kevin, nice question, but, you know, gravity decreases on the square of the distance, and therefore, you know, that planet X would be so far away that it wouldn't affect us at all. But I cannot say that it won't, because I feel that it is possible and most likely will happen, but I don't think it will be as strong as like an asteroid or a minor planet passing close to the Earth where its core gravitational force would rip apart each planet. I don't think it's going to be that strong, but it is possible that it will interfere with our orbit, and if our orbit becomes unstable and we wobble a bit, then that could certainly precipitate a number of issues on the planet if we're already approaching an unstable core.
When we look at...
A lot of people are asking me, you have to have a glass ball to figure out.
When we look at pictures of our solar system, we're almost always looking at a flat photograph. And our solar system obviously is not stationary and flat. The entire solar system is moving very rapidly. Everything in the solar system is moving. And as things move, They have various forces associated with them. And so when I say things, I'm talking about everything from meteorites to planets, to stars. But as they move, they have various forces associated with them, moving with them and creating waves and harmonics of those waves in a 360 by 360 by 360 sphere around the thing that's moving. Creating, if I can use the term, a bow shock. So if you have an incoming planet, and if it's fairly massive, as you've described, wouldn't we have, long before that planet reaches us, the effects of the bow shock of the forces associated with that planet?
I think so. I don't know what the strength of that bow shock wave would be this far in, but I think we would feel it, yes. And that's what we'll be able to test with this kind of experiment.
Okay, we have to step away for break. We'll come back to that when we get to the other side of this break. and welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. My guest this evening, Stan Deo. Stan, whenever we went to break, we're talking about this bow shock effect. Whenever the sun has when there's a big solar flare, within 8 minutes we begin to feel the effects, and those increase over the next several days. If there's a coronal mass ejection, those particles begin to hit the Earth, and they hit that magnetic field and begin to course around the Earth and out into space. Of course, some of them filter through, and we see the result as the aurora borealis. So that's sort of what I have in mind for a massive planet coming through, that the bow shock of the forces running in front of that planet as it's pushing through at some point have to begin contacting the magnetic field of the Earth. And even if it's weak, it has to start causing some effect. And as it gets closer, that effect would crescendo. And if there's a connection between magnetism and gravity, then it would seem to me that the effect would crescendo into possibly what you have observed with your experiments.
Well, let me say that the magnetic effects, purely magnetic effects between planets with magnetic fields, those effects you'd have to be a lot closer, like as close as the moon or whatever, to see significant changes. And by that time, the core gravitational effects that standard physics uses would rip the planets apart. But when you're talking about a bow shockwave, you're talking about a bow shockwave in the gravitational containment field, which is this new field that NASA has noticed and mentioned and is puzzled by, and that my theory is explaining. And it's a weaker field in that it's not as strong as gravity, or not as strong, you know, core gravity, or as strong as a magnetic field. For this planet you're talking about to make a bow shockwave, it's got to make a bow shockwave in something. And it's the ether fluid space we're talking about. I'm reviving what James Clerk Maxwell and the scientists back in the 19th century called the fluid of space. And I'm saying, as many other physicists have said in the late and early 50s, or just in the 50s entirely, 1950s, that we should revise our equations and concepts of the whole universe and make them fluid equations for behaviors of fluids, because the behavior of galaxies, planets, stars, etc., all of them with gravitational fields, behave in a fluid-like manner and could be described with fluid equations. Now, they're not the simplest thing in the world. That's why a lot of people didn't use them. But if that is the case, then it's like a lever arm. When you've got a great, big, huge diameter, weak field out there, this fluid is producing a weak field way out there, way away from the sun, and this mystery planet comes in with its own weak fields, but it impacts, makes that bow shockwave in that spinning ring way out there. It is going to focus that energy of that collision down to the inner rings, which are all connected by this spiral network of fluid. And by the time it gets down to where we are, it's going to be magnified many times what it is out there where it's impacting that containment orbit, or you know, in that fluid. So indirectly what you're saying, I think, will happen and may be happening now because of that bow shockwave further out than normal magnetism or gravity would affect our planet. It's the incoming inertia of that orbit colliding with the orbits of the outer planets and now the inner planets, because it's been carried down by that fluid. Does that make sense?
Well, it does. And let me add this to the thought and see what you think about it. Let's go back to that solar flare. Particles leave the sun at millions of miles per hour. And they head this way. And they go around the Earth and stream on outward into space. But as that shock wave is coming, at least in the sector of those particles that it's contacting, we have two bodies pushing against each other. We have the outflow of the particles, and we have the inflow of the shock wave. And as the planet continues to move forward, wouldn't it be, in essence, compressing the movement of those outflowing particles, slowing them, compressing them, so that we get more effect than if space were empty?
An interesting thought. Let me say that one of the reasons that scientists were not able to find evidence, using the Michelson-Morley experiment, evidence that the Earth was moving through a fluid was because they did not run the tests to say maybe the fluid is moving Earth. And in that case, Earth would not be making a bow shockwave, per se. It is traveling in a ring that is moving the Earth along. So the particles coming into the Earth from the sun would certainly be impacting our bow shockwave of magnetic field, and more so than the gravitational containment field. So the bow shockwave, I think, in that case, would be the magnetic interaction with the particles, the protons coming, versus the gravitational wave. Do you follow what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm. So you see magnetism as being causal for gravity?
No.
No?
No. Magnetism is a very concentrated event when conductive atoms that can conduct electric current are close enough together in either a fixed lattice or a constant current flow to generate a low-pressure area in the space around it. And that's what generates the illusion of gravity, or sorry, of magnetism attracting things. In essence, particles are pushed into tight orbits which center on the object that is magnetic. And this is in a way like the gravity waves, but it is a closer thing and a higher frequency thing, especially with atoms. So if we have the equivalent of a solar containment magnetic field, it would be much weaker than terrestrial or other planets with magnetic fields. So there are some relations between magnetism, because it's got an electricity, a flow of electricity creating it, and related to gravity. But the interaction between electricity and gravity do not necessarily mean that magnetism and gravity interact per se.
Okay. And we can see that on Mars, because Mars does not have a magnetic field, but right. It does have gravity.
It may have had, it may have had a magnetic field in the past, but certainly it's not detectable at the moment, as far as I know.
All right, so I'm very, very curious about what could be the cause of this gravitational inversion that you've noticed. And you mentioned something going on at the core of the planet that could be causing that, and I've looked for something external. Between the two, which do you think is most likely?
What is causing, or what might cause the inversion, you're saying?
Uh-huh.
Okay. Well, first of all, let me give you an experiment. Let's visualize an experiment to do with a glass of water.
Okay, we got a couple of minutes.
Okay, glass of water, you put some sand in it, some white sand and some iron filings, and you stir up the glass of water. It will form a vortex down the center of the glass, and when it starts to slow down, it'll form a cone of sand on the outside of the heavier iron particles, and there'll be a little vortex tip right above it. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
Now, if you've ever watched a stirred glass and watch that little tip of that vortex, as it's slowing down, it will bounce, it will bob up and down that tip. It's going through a cyclic change there. Now, I think that something of this nature is occurring, and we're still modeling this, inside the planets, so that there's a periodic winding up of the top, if you wish, and it winds it up just so far until the energy density is great enough that it reflects it back and causes a flip-flop to conserve momentum. I know that's a technical way to explain it, but it's like a string wound too tight inside, and it reaches a point where it either has to just suddenly stop and run backwards or flip over and keep spinning in the same direction. Stress relief on the core. Mm-hmm. One of the arguments against a hollow Earth has been in the past that the Earth has a certain mass, and it does. And they said, therefore, if the Earth is solid all the way through, and the mass of the planet is blah, 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 and it'll get more concentrated in the center and have an iron core. Now then, there's argument that says, well, it's not all iron. It might be some nickel in it. Well, there might be some cadmium in it. And what we did is I ran experiments in Earth.
We're being cut off by the break, Stan. We'll come back to that when we come back from this break. Don't go away, folks. We'll be right back. Welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show, and for those of you joining us just now in this second hour, welcome aboard. We're glad to have you. My sincere sympathy for whatever has caused you to miss the first hour, but we're glad you're here now. My guest this evening is Stan Deo, and take this to the bank, folks. If you missed the first hour, you have missed, oh, two or three universes of information. So, that's accounts for my sympathy for why you whatever caused you to miss. Stan, I think it's extremely significant that when you did your calculations for where the orbits have to be, and I know you've already explained it. I'm going to get you to explain how you calculated that. I want you to explain it again, but I think it's extremely significant that when you did this, you didn't think very much of Zachariah Sitchin's Nibiru, and yet you found an orbit that fairly precisely fits his description. So tell us again how you calculated that.
Well, without kind of making people's eyes cross with the equation, it's a simple algebraic equation where I calculated the volume of, say, Mercury's orbit, and then I expand that volume equally out to the next orbit. And it's a calculation, basically, that tells you that there's a certain amount of space or energy in space in each orbit, and that tells you the radius of, and it increases at a particular ratio as you go further out. Basically, it's like looking when you throw a stone into a pond, and there are waves that go out from that, ripples that head out toward the shore. But if you have, say, like a drill spinning in the water, and that drill is spinning the water around the drill bit, it will make standing waves. And if you put it in a bucket of paint that's even thicker than water, you can see these waves form. And as long as you've got that drill running at the same speed, those ripples will be in the same distance from the drill bit. And they'll also have little threads connecting them, little arms connecting them to the drill bit. But it was using this concept and the amount of energy distributed in that volume of space that allowed me to calculate where planets have to orbit. And using that, I found some empty orbits, about six. And one of those was the orbit that we're talking about for that planet Nibiru. And while we're on that, rehashing that, let me say that one of the things I thought was absolutely unbelievable in what Sitchin was saying was that there were inhabitants on this planet Nibiru, and when they came close to the sun and the earth during that 11 to 15 year period, that they hopped off of their planet over onto our planet, visited with us and shared stuff, and then dropped back onto their planet and went on back out into the outer reaches of the solar system. The problem with that is that way out there beyond Neptune, beyond Pluto, beyond the Kuiper belt, you know, it's cold. It's really cold. And you're not going to grow things because the light is so weak out that far from the sun. So how would these people live? How could they live in that kind of environment and grow food? And then as I got further into my gravitational theory and looked inside planets and there was a hot core, the penny dropped. Maybe this Nibiru has people living inside of it, you know, walking around upside down to our concept, but walking on the inner surface of the planet with gravity reversed. And then they could have the light of their internal core as their artificial sun, and it would be warm, they could grow food and have industry, and maybe they have a way to get out the polar holes that is more advanced than just waiting on it to open up on its own. So therefore, they could live out there. And when they get close, they could drop off, you know, of their planet onto ours and back onto theirs and go back out until their planet gets old and too cold and they can't live it out there anymore. So did I explain it any better?
Yeah, that explains it. Okay. What I want to do is I want to invite our audience to join us in this discussion. And folks, I know you've got questions, you've got comments, and let me tell you, after every show, I get email from people, and this is not a complaint, I'm just informing you, I get email from people who say, I can't believe you didn't ask this, I can't believe you didn't say this, and my response is, I can't believe you didn't call. When I open the phone lines, it's because I cannot think of every question, that's a fact. Pretty sharp, but I'm not God. All right. So let me open the phone lines so you can call with your questions or your comments. The telephone number is 623-444-5889. Again, that's 623-444-5889. The toll-free number in the USA and Canada is 888-223-4599. And if you are outside of the USA and outside of Canada, I don't have a toll-free number for out there. But what I do have is, if you can either call the main number, which is an international long-distance call for you, or you can use the flash message option on my website. Just go over to my website, kevinsmithshow.com, scroll down, you see the picture about tonight's show, and to the right of that, on the right side of that picture, you'll see a link that says flash message, and that is only for people who are not in the USA and not in Canada. All right, let's go to the telephone. Caller, you're live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name and from where are you calling?
Kevin, this is Brent from Wyoming.
Hello, Brent.
Stan, I actually have two questions for you. One of them is kind of brief, so I'll ask it first. You say there are six orbits that are empty, or one of them may have this Nibiru planet in it. But in the early 70s, there was some information suppressed about several minor planets. It was, Kevin knows what I'm talking about. They were actually, the information was actually suppressed. Could they be these other five orbits?
Well, they could be. I'm just looking here at the images I've got on the website for the show tonight, and there's one that's, let's see, where is it? It's the one, two, three. It's the fourth row down in the middle. It shows a cutaway of the solar system and the empty orbits. I've put purple planets in there to show you which ones are empty. And in there, if you look real close, in fact, I think it's the next one to that. Yeah, the one that shows Jupiter. If you look real close, you can see that there's one, two, three minor planet orbits, one close to Jupiter, one in between the asteroid belt and Mars, and one between Venus and Mercury. So, yes, they could be. Next question.
Okay, now, if I understand your gravitational calculations correctly, given the decreasing velocities of Voyager 1 and Voyager 2, would it be reasonable for me to suggest that a solar system is a closed system in that nothing physical can leave that solar system either of its own accord or with the assistance of our currently publicly acknowledged levels of technology?
Well, let's say it would be very difficult because they're using chemical thrust rockets instead of gravitational field devices. And since that's not official and not public, really, yes, I think that it would be very difficult with low-velocity ships or, you know, projectiles or whatever else to escape the system. Eventually, this weaker gravitational force would slow you down. And that's what's happening to the, I think it's Pioneer 10 and 11, isn't it?
Yes.
I don't know.
Anyway,
I was just putting Voyager 1 and 2 because it's one of the ones I remember.
Oh, that's right. It is. You're exactly right, Brent. It's Voyager 1 and 2.
I think the article's on Pioneer 10 and 11, though. But anyway, I could be wrong.
Well, all four of them are out there, so it could be.
And there's also Viking, well, that's the lander.
You're in Wyoming, are you?
Yeah.
I-25-990. What, is that where you are, close to that intersection?
Yeah.
Have you been noticing any earthquakes recently?
Not in this part. It's, I know there's some over by Yellowstone where my brother lives up in Montana, about 20 miles from Yellowstone, but they're relatively minor.
But he has been feeling them, right?
I don't know if he's felt them or not, because he's on horseback most of the time.
So how does he know that there have been minor earthquakes?
Well, I check the USGS earthquake site every day.
Ah. Have you noticed, then, in the last 2-3 weeks, since about February the 2nd, that a lot of the minor earthquakes in the Yellowstone Park area have been deleted?
Yes, I have.
Do you think that's strange?
All I will say is it doesn't surprise me that they don't want people to know what's going on.
Well, the official explanation, because we've had contact with the USGS over this, and Holly's put it up on our website, the official explanation is that ice built up on the earthquake sensors in Yellowstone, and it's been giving false readings of earthquakes, and as soon as a human reviews the earthquake data, they delete that earthquake. Now, it's funny. They're saying that all these things froze up and didn't work right, but through January, they had, you know, like 40 or 50, like a flurry of earthquakes at Yellowstone, which they'll accept in the same cold period. And if you go over to Arkansas, there's been over 700 earthquakes in the last 6 months, 50 in just the past week. And they're trying to say, the locals are saying, not the USGS, but the locals, it must be the gas company drilling out there causing this. 700 earthquakes? I don't think so. When I plotted these things on on Google Earth, on a global plot, you can see that on my website there, down where you see all the earthquake plots looking at the Earth, and particularly the United States. There is something going on in Yellowstone. I can see it in the earthquakes, the patterns there. On the northwest corner of the magma pool underneath Yellowstone, I am sure something is going on, because a lot of earthquakes, small ones, have been occurring in that, the tremors, like they did a couple years back when we had a flare-up and a lot of interest by the scientific community in Yellowstone. Now, I'm starting to see a pattern here over in the New Madrid area, where nothing's going to happen, of course, where we had all those earthquakes in Arkansas, and we had a lot in Oklahoma, which is not even officially part of the New Madrid fault. We see that the Army was holding exercises there on how to take care of millions of people in a New Madrid earthquake relief. Now, there's not enough evidence there at the moment to say that New Madrid's going, but coincidentally, we looked at a map that Holly's got about the ash fall from the last time, you know, hundreds of thousands of years ago that Yellowstone erupted, and the ash fall stopped short of the New Madrid area, Mississippi River area. Is that a staging area to pick up survivors? You got to ask yourself. And if you get back over to Yellowstone, in the last 12, 14 months, I've plotted earthquakes right up from the Sierra Madres, right up through the Rocky Mountains and up into Canada, and you will see a new, like, activity zone, a ribbon like a snake running right up, diving off into Yellowstone, a northwest corner, and back up into Washington State, into that area there, right close to it, there at the tip of Idaho. So I think I'm getting a sense that something big is happening, and they're just not making it official because it would create a panic. But, you know, I'm on alert to see if I get any more information on either the Arkansas quakes, the Oklahoma quakes, or the Yellowstone quakes in the northwest corner of it, because I think that thing is becoming active again.
It very well could be.
I heard of bison and stuff, you know, running out of there and things. I mean, it's just things that don't add up. The report, the excuses they give don't make sense.
Mm-hmm. All right, back to the telephone. Caller, you're live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name and from where are you calling?
This is Mary in Houston.
Hello, Mary.
Hello, Mary.
Hello. I have a couple of comments, and then I'll take the answers from them offline. My first comment is, I'm with you with the earthquakes, because I've been watching the USGS maps of the Pacific Rim, and it's really lit up. I mean, it's almost a complete circle with earthquakes. And Chile has had, I think, six in the past 30 days, six major earthquakes offshore. And my second comment is that you were talking about when the Earth gets, well, when this planet X gets close to the Earth, and you were stating that when it's not close to the Earth, it's further out in space, so it would be very hard for aliens to live on that planet because it would be so cold. Well, I think sort of past that, because we have ants on planet Earth that actually grow their own food underground, and they use a chemical-like spray that they spray the area where they grow their own fungus and molds in which they eat. And I sort of think of them, maybe they're a blind race that they don't need UV rays to see. And they could live in conditions like that, because ants pretty much can live in the freezing cold and in extreme heat. And my third comment was that I really feel that all this weather is going to just simply get worse, because there's got to be something going on with the Earth or some type of environmental change with all these major earthquakes striking the Pacific Rim. And I'll take your comments offline.
Thank you, Mary. Some very good comments. On your first comment about the earthquakes, the Richter 6 quakes in Chile, I've got on the website there in the show images, the first earthquake picture I've got there is a Google Earth kind of three-dimensional view of the earthquakes in the last 14 months in Chile. Not just the Richter 6s, but all of them. And there are 700 or 800 of them. It is the hottest spot on that Pacific Ring of Fire you're talking about. I've never seen that many in such a short time, in the time I've been looking at the earthquake data. Now, along your theory about, or along your statement about the Ring of Fire being active all the way around, every place where there's been pressure buildup for an earthquake, you know, like 8, or Richter 8 or 9, every place along the Ring of Fire and into the Indonesian Trench, going west into the Indian Ocean, every place that had a buildup like that in the last 50 years has released its pressure in a massive earthquake, except for one place. And that is the Juan de Fuca plate, right up offshore of Oregon and Washington State. And it is prime for a massive Richter 8.5 to 9 earthquake, and I would say soon. Now, the other thing about the planet, the people living on Planet X could be like ants living in that environment. I am aware that there are living microbes and there are living, swimming, bigger forms of life around the 400-degree Fahrenheit smokers, which are underwater vents for superheated water on the ocean floor, and they're also in the Pacific. And nearly 1,100 of them have been mapped. Now, these microbes and these smaller life forms, fish life forms, and like crabs, do live in that hot environment. I don't know how, but they do. And there is evidence that there might be life in frozen structures on one of the moons of Jupiter. But the thing is, as far away as we're talking about from the sun that Planet X might be in its far orbit, things would absolutely just not move. They would be frozen solid. You're not going to grow any fungus when there's nothing moving. It is locked tight. But I still think that living inside the planet, they would have enough heat to live comfortably. Maybe not as comfortable an environment as we've got, but they would have a way to live and generate their own heat and energy, and perhaps be a lot further along in their technological development than we are. And maybe at that point, they've gone back out onto the surface with energy producing the heat and light that they need to live and live happily out there. I don't know. I mean, how far ahead of us are they if they are there? Kevin, what was the third comment she made?
I'm not sure.
I got you, didn't I?
Yeah, I'm not sure. I think it had to do with the earthquakes in Chile. But let me ask you now, you've brought up about Yellowstone, and they say it's a super volcano. If this thing is showing signs that it's about to go, I don't see anything in the history of the governments that have existed here in the United States, and they change, of course, with each election. I don't see anything in the history of these governments that suggests they're going to tell us the truth and tell us that it's coming. Do you?
Well, Kevin, let's play this game. Let's say that you were in charge of the Earth as a global community, not just the United States, but the Earth. And you knew that a life-extinguishing event was perhaps about to happen, but you weren't sure. You're about 90% certain, but you weren't sure, like a Yellowstone eruption. Now, would you, in good conscience, tell everyone, oh, excuse me, look, I'm pretty sure that in about a month the life as we know it's going to stop, and that 90% of the planet will die and 10% of us will live through it. Now would you do that and create the panic, or would you try to figure out a way to gently, unofficially warn people through leaks of intelligence, saying, those of you that see between the news reports what I'm really trying to tell you, get prepared and do your best to survive, and mm-hmm. try to put an infrastructure out there to rebuild after the event hits. Wouldn't you try to do the latter?
I would. I would do the latter. However, it's a little bit different here, in that Yellowstone is not an earth killer. It's something that's going to make it very, very uncomfortable for a lot of the earth. But as you said, about 100,000 years ago when it blew last time, the ash boundary ends just short of the New Madrid Fault. So they know there is at least a possibility of a safe zone. And you couple that with taking earthquakes off the chart and saying it's because the instruments were frozen, that doesn't sound to me like you're leaking information to help people.
Well, yes. Well, I have more reason to say what I'm saying than I've told you. But anyway, let's get back to the life-extincting event of the supervolcano at Yellowstone going off. The last time that something like that happened, we don't quite have a record of how it affected the planet, but the forecasts are that although the ashfall, the heavy ashfall, was, 600-700 miles away, maybe further, but to the Mississippi, the cloud, the nuclear winter cloud that was thrown up into higher atmosphere, killed crops for years after that, because there wasn't enough sun getting through and it was cold. Mm-hmm. And that is what would be the ELE event. Not so much the ashfall or the immediate magma burns and things. It's the threat to the food chain. And right now, as that woman was saying about the weather, as Mary was saying, our food crops are being hit by floods, by fires. I mean, look at Australia down there. Unusual things. And in China, they're having a drought, and it's draining. We've got locusts. There are a number of things that are hitting our food chain, and people that are shopping every week and on fixed incomes will tell you, I can't afford food anymore. It's getting too expensive. And this is just the beginning. So when you have an ELE that throws a cloud of dust up, and this scenario has been run past in nuclear war scenarios as well, if a certain number of nuclear devices go off and throw high-altitude dust around the planet, we could have 2 years of nuclear winter covers from the clouds, and that would kill most of the food chain and us.
Mm-hmm.
So, I consider, a massive eruption by either Yellowstone or by Lake Taupo in the North Island of New Zealand, both of those are very, very sensitive areas, and I think that they're very possible for more reasons than one. I was given a dream vision showing what's going to happen down in Taupo with that lake there.
All right, we have to step away for break. We'll pick up there when we come back. Don't go away, folks. Get your fingers warmed up. You'll have a few minutes left to give us a call.
Get the best of me. That girl's got my heart believing.
Welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. My guest this evening is Stan Deo. Stan, I cut you off in mid-sentence, and I want to let you finish your thought.
You know what? I've gone blank. What was I talking
about? Well, we'll move on because I'm blank, too. That's what you get, folks, a couple of old guys. We forget what we were talking about. Stan. Oh, let me remind everybody that the telephone lines are open, 623-444-5889, or toll-free in the U.S. and Canada, 888-223-4599. If you live outside of the USA and you live outside of Canada, you can send me a flash message, and you can't send me a flash message if you're in the USA or Canada, and you can't send me one that says, "You're out in the Atlantic Ocean," like this one. I won't read it, okay? Got to be honest with me. All right, Stan, how likely do you think it is, and caller, just hang on for just a moment, how likely do you think it is that Yellowstone is going to blow soon?
Well, I don't know whether it will blow, but I do think that we will see some magma movement that's putting gases in the air around the area. If we can get more reports from people who live in the area who know more about the park than I do, for sure, we might be able to see something before it hits. But normally you'll see percussive earthquakes, tremors, and harmonic tremors, certain ones equally spaced. And I could be wrong, but it looked like some of those earthquakes, there was about 12 of them they deleted, with the seismographs that went with them, did indicate harmonic tremors in the northwest corner. And that usually indicates magma moving up to the surface. Now, whether it'll be a big blow or a small blow or just a normal volcano or a magma leak, you know, like flowing lava, I couldn't tell you. I just don't know enough about it to be an expert. But I do feel that it's something that people in the area who have contacts in the area who live there should be aware of. And if they feel that there's more to it than we're thinking, then maybe they ought to let the rest of us know.
Very good. Caller, you're live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name and from where are you calling?
It's Tony from Alberta calling.
Hello, Tony.
How are you?
Good.
I have a couple questions for Stan.
Okay, go ahead.
I was just wondering, if Nibiru is coming in and is getting close to the sun, On some other sites, what they have said, that this would cause a big solar flare by the sun that could really hurt the Earth. Do you agree with that?
Well, I agree it's possible. I mean, all you have to do is look at some of the recent comets that have come and hit the sun, and a flare happens right after that. The flare, of course, to be of effect on the Earth, would have to be what they call Earth-directed. And there's a lot of space, there's a lot of angles around the sun that thing could come in and cause the flares that would miss us. There's more that would miss us than would hit us. However, Tony, having said that, as a student of biblical prophecy, and as a guest of the Hopi, that Holly and I were down there, the Hopi Indians, both sources said that there's going to be a period of time, like probably in weeks, where the sun will be so hot that it'll burn a third of the grass and the trees on the earth. And to me, that says it right there. Something's going to happen with the sun that's going to cook a third of the planet. And it's about a third of the surface area that's facing the sun at any one point in time. So I suspect it will be some sort of a very hot radiation release that's traveling so fast that in 8 minutes it's upon us and cooks that part of the planet. If it were something heavier like protons and things, like Kevin was saying, you look at that following after 24 to 48 hours before it hits the planet, you'd have time to make preparations. So I think that's what's going to do it.
Okay. So how would we protect ourselves then?
Well, the Hopi are digging mud kivas or igloos under the ground there in Arizona, and they're stocking it, you know, it's like 1.5 to 2 foot thick mud things under the surface of the earth, and they're stocking it with corn and beans that they put into burned wood ash to preserve it, and water, and enough for about 3 or 4 weeks. So that's how they're doing it. The Bible says that when this solar event occurs, that men will want rocks to fall on them and hide them, and they will try to hide in caves from the sun and from the fury of God's judgment, in essence, what it's saying. But you want to be in caves or, you know, deep areas to protect yourself if you're in that part of the earth that is getting hit. And it may be only a several-hour event, and then there will be fires after that and smoke, you know, circling the planet. Lord only knows what the attendant events will be, but we're advising people to put food stores, you know, down in their basements, and in some cases where they can, to bury them down a bit. And Holly's book, The Dare to Prepare book, has about 67 chapters in it, which tell you how to prepare for a number of events, including nuclear war and how to survive that. And it is very survivable. You know, you can do it in your house even if the fallout is headed for your house from the central blast area and you're not in that. There are ways to shelter in your house and protect yourself from the radiation of the fallout for about 3 weeks until it's safe to go outside. So we've done everything we can as far as what we can find with practical resources for humans to use to endure that kind of disaster and floods and earthquakes and tornadoes and et cetera, et cetera. What we're talking about here is a one-of-a-kind event, and I can only draw on the prophecies given to the Hopi and to the prophets of the Old Testament and the New Testament and say, okay, find a cave or insulate your basement somehow or another and plan to live there, you know, for the duration of it, for a couple of weeks.
Okay. Okay, Scott, can I ask another question?
Yeah, go ahead.
You know, okay, I was wondering, you said when the gravitational pull, that the Earth is going to expand, like, you know, like before, like all the continents just pulled apart.
Right.
So if this happened again, would this change North America's zone where they get warmer or colder?
It depends on how the axis of the planet stabilizes after that. We're dealing with something, the core of the planet spinning very rapidly down deep inside, and the Earth itself turning at a kind of a wobble. It's like a top you've spun on the floor, and it's getting tired, and how that top kind of wobbles around, you know, it doesn't spin straight. And because of this, and because the outer core of the planet is not fixed over a certain position, it moves over the internal workings of the planet, we could slip and go, you know, anywhere. I mean, it's a hard question to answer because we haven't got enough hard data about the inside of the Earth and its mechanism to predict exactly where it's going to happen, just that this kind of stuff will happen. So, yes, we could have deserts becoming equatorial things with lots of rain and blooming. In fact, the Bible does say the deserts will bloom. It doesn't say how, but there is one statement in there that the earth will reel like a drunken man in this time, which does indicate what you're saying will happen, is that it will wobble heavily. And during that time, of course, and perhaps after that, places that were equatorial may no longer be that way. They may be a new North Pole. And this may explain why the mammoths had their last meal in their mouth when they were quick frozen, because the surface of the planet moved to a different attitude and they were suddenly semi-polar in Alaska or Siberia or somewhere, you see.
All right, Tony, thank you for the call. Very good questions.
Mm-hmm.
623-444-5889. 623-444-5889. Or toll-free in the USA and Canada, 888-223-4599. And if you're outside of the USA and Canada, you can send me a flash message, and I will read it here on the air, and we'll ask our guest to respond to it. We have one from Nick in Costa Rica that says, what you two old guys forgot before break was Stan was saying that he had a dream or vision about something. What was it? It interests me.
Ah, all right. Boy, it's a good thing they're listening, isn't it?
Well, that's right. Thanks, Nick in Costa Rica.
Okay, well, gee, that's a long way away. Okay, the dream vision I had was about this super volcano that's going to occur down in the North Island, New Zealand. And it wasn't just me that had it. There were a number of Christian folk there in the North Island that had it. And also the Maori, spiritual leader for the Maori down there, the woman, contacted me after I went on the radio and told them about it. She contacted me by email through a friend that I correspond with down there. And she said to tell me that this great eruption is going to happen. They've been shown that in their faith, in the Maori religion, and that preceding it, there will be a great scandal occur with a huge dam in China. And we assume it's the Three Gorges Dam. And she said the great scandal will be that the dam will fail in a certain part, one of the tributaries or the main dam, she's not sure, but it will fail, and it will be because of substandard timber being used in the bracing somewhere, logs, that the people in charge of it took part of the money that they were going to spend on high-quality wood, and they used cheap-quality wood, and that caused this thing to fail and kill lots of people. And then when we hear that shortly thereafter, the North Island of New Zealand, about half of it's going to disappear in the explosion of Lake Taupo. The last time that it erupted was in 87 A.D., and the Chinese astronomers in the Northern Hemisphere recorded 2 to 3 days of total darkness from the ash that it threw into the atmosphere of the Earth. So that was the dream vision I had there with that, and a lot of other people supported that. And in fact, when I said it on the radio, it was on Coast to Coast with Art Bell at that time, and I did it over a conference line there in New Zealand while we were there by the lake, because steam was coming out of the ground at the time when I was talking to him. And the New Zealand Tourist Bureau asked me never to come back to New Zealand because it was hurting tourism.
You were bad for business.
Yeah, and you know what? Ruapehu, Mount Ruapehu on the edge of Lake Taupo was bubbling up at that time, and I flew over in a single-engine airplane as a pilot, and we could see the bubbling lake of sulfuric acid there, green acid on the top. And on the, I think it's the western side, where there was snowpack on the side of the volcano, There were idiots skiing down that thing, you know, thinking this is great fun. And I'm thinking, boy, you guys are crazy.
Well, some people get a thrill out of taking their lives in their hands. Let's go back to the telephone. Caller, you're live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name and from where are you calling?
This is Greg in Kentucky.
Hello, Greg.
Hi, Greg.
Hey, Kevin. Hey, Stan.
Hi. Go ahead.
I couldn't really remember when he was talking about the planet out in the outer solar system. Could that be Tyche, the one that NASA's been talking about, the giant hidden planet?
Yeah.
Are you aware of that?
Yes. In fact, Holly's got
articles. It's spelled T-Y-C-A-T.
Yep, Tyche. Tacky Tyche. Yep.
So does that fit the description of Nibiru?
It's bigger than I thought it would be, but it could be. And I know that NASA's been looking for, and they called it Planet X-2 in the beginning before it became unpopular, but or politically incorrect or something or other. But there's some planet big enough to be perturbing or disturbing the orbit of Neptune and Uranus. So, yeah, it may be that that they will announce. If it's out in the Oort cloud, as far as they're saying, though, it doesn't fit the description of a planet that would disturb the orbits of Neptune and Uranus. That's something in closer, which may be a smaller Planet X,
mm-hmm.
in my opinion.
Especially if it being a brown dwarf.
Well, it could be. It might be the reason that we need infrared telescopes to image the device and why amateurs have not been able to see it in the Southern Hemisphere.
All right, Greg, thanks for the call. We have to step away for a break. We'll be back right after this.
I can't wait any longer.
Welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. My guest this evening is Stan Deo. Stan, we have a caller online. So let's go straight to the telephone. Caller, you are live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name and from where are you calling? Okay, the caller is not there. All right. Stan, folks, we still have time for you to call. If you wish to call in, we have time for one, maybe two calls. But please, don't be listening to your radio. Listen to the telephone. Caller, you're live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name and from where are you calling?
Yeah, hi, Kevin. This is James from California.
Hello, James.
Yeah, I've got a question for your guest, Stan. Hey, Stan, I'm over on your website, and I'm checking out a picture here you have of the orbits of planets.
Right.
And it seems like you've got a couple of extra planets in there between Saturn, very large planets, between Saturn and Jupiter, and it looks like Neptune and Saturn.
Right.
Well, is this a part of your theory, and why are they there? And do you know they're in direct contradiction to Bode's law?
Okay, has explained those as empty orbits, and on the picture, those purple planets are there to show you where they would be if there were planets in those orbits. Go ahead, Stan.
James, Bode's law was fairly accurate, not totally accurate, in predicting the orbits of the planets. My spacing incorporates the spacings like Bode's law did, with the progression coming out from the center of the solar system outward. And where those purple planets are missing planets. They are stable orbits, but there's no planet in them. That's why I colored them purple. And you'll find some down in the inner planets in the picture to the right of that, which is inside Jupiter's orbit. You'll see three of them in there, one between Mercury and Venus, one between the asteroid belt and Mars, and one between Jupiter and the asteroid belt. But using this progression, it fit a lot better than Bode's law did. Neptune still is inside the orbit, even like in Bode's law, but that is because of the perturbation of another mass out there. Even NASA has agreed to that. Did that answer your question?
Yeah, the other question is, do you think that there's a, you're saying there's a large planetary body out there, like NASA just recently claimed. Are you saying that that's in a stable orbit, or are you actually saying that that's coming in towards the sun?
I think it's coming in toward the sun. I think it's a long elliptical orbit. I don't think it's parabolic or hyperbolic. I think it's an elliptical orbit, like a long stretched egg shape, you know, but very thin. And its orbit is inclined to the ecliptic plane, I think, at around 23 degrees, as far as I can calculate from the other factors we've got. That is, its mean orbit is a stable orbit at 250 AUs.
Okay. James, thanks much for the call. Thanks for the questions. Now let me ask you a question, Stan. You think that this is inclined, this orbit is ecliptic and inclined at 23 degrees. The Earth's axis is tilted by 23 to 24 degrees. Any relationship?
I hadn't actually thought about that, but I think this is independent of the Earth's tilt to its own orbit. Its own orbit is fairly, you know, fairly close to the ecliptic plane. It's not deviating that much, but most of the orbits have some deviation off of the imaginary ecliptic plane. In the paper I'm doing, I have similar type illustrations which show the relationships and the tilts of the orbits. But this, Pluto is pretty eccentric too, but it's probably a lost moon off of one of the outer planets. But
okay, so there's no known relationship between those two.
Not that I know of. I know it seems similar, but I've run several scenarios. I think approximately 23 degrees fits best, but I could be wrong.
All right. Caller, you're live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name and from where are you calling?
Hi, this is Alan from Oregon.
Hello, Alan.
Stan, I've got a question. I'm looking at your picture called Solar System's Unfilled Outer Orbits, and you talked about a fluid that defines the orbits. It occurred to me that when this new planet comes through the solar system south to north, it's going to perturb all of those forces that define those orbits, and it'll be like a tidal force, I suppose, on all the planets in our solar system, and would add stress to the Earth and add to the earthquakes and everything beyond everything else that's been talked about. Is that how you see it?
Yes, it is, and it depends on where a planet is in its orbit when this planet X perturbs the circular, you know, the stable orbit, as to how much effect it will have on the inner planets. But I do think we're going to see some disturbances of the inner planets as this thing approaches.
So you think it's going to be more on the inner planets?
Yes, and simply because the extreme elliptic orbit that this planet X would have, it will dive into the solar system at around the orbit of the asteroid belt, probably inside of that, as I estimate, and go around behind the sun and then back into that same orbit and exit. So the inner planets are probably going to get hit worse than the outer planets.
So it's going to...
If you look at it, too, Venus spins backwards in its orbit, and some of the records that Velikovsky spoke of indicated that Venus came in and was an interloper in modern times of man. You know, in the last 4,000 or 5,000 years, it came in and adopted that orbit. And I suspect that Venus eventually will flip-flop and start spinning like all the other planets in the direction of our orbit.
Well, that answers my question.
Thank you, sir.
Thanks for the call.
Thank you.
All right. Stan, what you've shared with us tonight is very exciting information and thoroughly engaging information. Like I said, for you, it may just be plain vanilla stuff because you deal with it every day. But very, very interesting information for us. Now, as you look at the broad overview of everything we've talked about, what do you think is the single most important thing we ought to carry away from this show tonight?
Well, that life is going to change, not for the better, for the short term, and that people ought to be preparing for physical damage to the planet and to our lifestyle, of a big alteration, and preparing as much as you possibly can to be on your own and away from infrastructure that supports you. That means grow your own food or learn how to do it inside the house or something, or get a lot of freeze-dried food and water and stuff stored away. And also be able to have walking gear and packs and stuff, and maybe a travois to take your goods along the road somewhere if you have to migrate from your area for some reason. And secondly, although I haven't covered it much in the show, all of us have to die sometime, but some of us might have to die prematurely if we don't watch it. And the point I'm trying to make is it's a good time to get close to our Creator, you know, because you might be meeting Him sooner than you thought. And so spiritual